You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
My name is Tim Martin. I'm the executive director of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. As a housekeeping matter, this is the third in a series of events on privacy. We are the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. We take no positions on legislation. We've been in existence since 1996, 1997, just doing balanced and fair briefings for congressional staff on the issues that affect the Internet generally. So we are a nonprofit. We work in conjunction with the Congressional Internet Caucus, the co-chairs of which are Congressman Goodlatte and Congressman Eshoo on the House side. On the Senate side, it's Senator Thune and Senator Leahy. And there's about 180 or 190 members of the Congressional Internet Caucus as well. Again, neither organization takes positions on legislation, but we try to keep staff up to date and briefed on the relevant issues that are before us. Today, we thought it was very important, going back to the end of last year and as things developed through the holidays, to brief congressional staff on the three major governmental initiatives on privacy that we felt were extremely significant, historically speaking, in the history of the Internet. One was the European Commission has introduced new rules updating its European Data Directive. That is going on right now. The draft is out. We had in March, we had Francois Labaye, who's the Director General of the European Commission, come and brief congressional staff in Rayburn on that, on their proposal. And the directive is a major piece of privacy legislation that governs how data is used in Europe. The second one was the White House introduced a privacy white paper calling for certain things. On April 2, Danny Weitzner from the White House came and briefed congressional staff on that. And this is the third in a series. The Federal Trade Commission in March introduced their privacy framework paper advocating for certain things, including some calls for congressional legislation. So all of them affect Congress in some way, shape, or form. We thought we'd do briefings sequentially on those. And then, if you'll bear with us today, what we decided to do was have a private sector panel after that FTC presentation to kind of debate all three of those privacy initiatives and what they all mean for Congress. So our focus is the congressional aspects and the congressional implications of these different initiatives. But as I said, for the first part, we're going to have someone from the Federal Trade Commission present the privacy framework report, and she will give a presentation. We'll do some Q&A with her, and then we'll introduce the private sector panel. We'll discuss all three initiatives. So we hope to swap through this really quickly, and please bear with us. With us today is Misha Mittal. She is with the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Privacy and Identity Protection. Misha has briefed congressional staff before on things like Do Not Track. She's been with the Federal Trade Commission for many, many years, and before that she was with Covington and Burling, and I'll introduce her in just 1 second. Following Misha will be Chris Wolf, who heads up the privacy practice at Hogan Lovells. He's also the co-founder and co-chair of the Future Privacy Forum, which is a privacy think tank here in the city. So I'll leave it in Chris's hand to moderate the Q&A with Misha. But right now, Misha from the Federal Trade Commission.
Thanks, Tim, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. I would note that we have some chairs over here, so if people are standing, or you can pull up a chair for yourself. Okay, so let me just start with some backgrounds for those of you who are not as familiar with the Federal Trade Commission report. In December 2010, we put out a preliminary framework for protecting consumers' privacy, and that framework had three basic elements. First, companies should implement protections for privacy as they develop products and services, not as an afterthought, and we call that privacy by design. Second, companies should simplify the way they provide choices to consumers about their information handling practices. And third, companies should improve the transparency of the data they collect and use about consumers. So we put out the staff report in December 2010, and we got about 450 comments on that report. And we issued our final report this March, which refines the framework. We don't change any of those three basic principles, but we do make certain refinements in response to the comments that we got. So what I'd like to do in the 15 minutes or so that I have for prepared remarks is I'll do three things. First, I'll talk a little bit about the big picture of the privacy report and what it means for congressional legislation, what it means for the administration. Second, I'd like to drill down and talk about some of the meat that we've put on the bones of the three basic principles, and I'll talk about privacy by design and simplified choice and transparency a little in a little more detail. And third, I'll talk about the next steps for implementation, at least at the FTC. So first, let me start with the big picture points, and I just make four main points. First, this is a commission report, not a staff report. Our preliminary report in December 2010 was a staff report, and this final report has been adopted by a majority of the commissioners. It seems a little bit inside baseball, but at least at the commission, it just is a little stronger to have a report be a commission report and not a staff report. The second point is about legislation. I think the main question I get about the privacy report is, do you recommend congressional legislation? And in the December 2010 report, we put out these principles, but we didn't take a position on whether they should be adopted by legislation or through self-regulation. Well, in this final report, we say that Congress should consider enacting baseline privacy legislation based on fundamental principles that we articulate in the report, which are in turn based on the fair information practice principles that have been around for over 30 years. We also reiterate our support for data breach notification legislation and general data security legislation. And we also reiterate our support for legislation that would improve the transparency of the data broker industry. And by data brokers, we mean companies that buy and sell consumers' data that are invisible to consumers. So, for example, when I go to Target, I give them my information. They're a first party. I know that they're collecting my information. I'm interacting with them. But what I may not know is that they may be selling data selling my data with data brokers who are in turn buying and selling data with others as well. So we've recommended legislation to improve the practices and increase transparency in the data broker industry. The third big picture point is that I often get asked, well, is this now how the FTC is going to enforce the FTC Act? Are these new rules of the road? Are they new quasi-legislative principles? And the answer is no, that unless Congress enacts legislation, these principles are merely best practices for industry in order to implement, in order to improve consumer privacy. It's not going to be a template for an FTC enforcement. And finally, I often get asked, why is this consistent with the administration's white paper? What are the similarities and differences? And I think the response is that the two reports, the administration report and the FTC report, are entirely complementary and consistent. We are an independent agency, so we do have an independent view. But nonetheless, our reports are entirely consistent with each other. I think the difference between the two reports is that the administration report is a little bit more about implementation. Congress should enact legislation. The Department of Commerce is going to implement these codes of conduct and get together these multi-stakeholder groups to develop these codes of conduct. This is how we're going to engage further internationally. Whereas our report, I think, provides a little bit more guidance to industry. It drills down into beyond what are the basic principles, but what do the basic principles mean for different industries and for different types of practices that companies are considering. So that's the big picture. Now let me move on to what some of the specific principles and some of the specific things that we say about the principles in the report. Before I get to the three basic principles, let me just say a word about scope. When we first proposed this framework back in December 2010, we said that it would apply to all companies that collect and use data that's reasonably linkable to a consumer computer or device. And traditionally, in the old days, we always thought about privacy in terms of these privacy protections should attach when there is personally identifiable information, defined as things like name, address, social security numbers, things that are uniquely identifiable to an individual. But I think in the past several years, there's been a realization that concept is somewhat obsolete, that these days, with more and more data being publicly available, you can easily take disparate bits of information and re-identify a consumer. Technologies have evolved. There's more information based in the public record so that people can do that. And so that was the basis for having this framework apply to any data that can be reasonably linked to a consumer computer or device. In the final report, we've made two clarifications and changes to that general approach. First, we got a lot of comments saying, well, do you really want to impose these requirements on small businesses? So one of the things we've done is we haven't made a small business exception, but we've said that if you collect data from fewer than 5,000 consumers and that data is not sensitive, in other words, if you even collect medical data of 100 consumers, you should still be subject to the framework. But if you collect non-sensitive data of fewer than 5,000 consumers and you don't share that data with third parties, then you shouldn't necessarily be subject to the framework. And the example we give is, let's say you're a cash-only food truck, you're getting people's email addresses, so agencies, you don't need to necessarily go through all the bells and whistles that we put in the privacy framework. So we have this recognition that for companies that collect less non-sensitive data about consumers, the framework's principles wouldn't necessarily apply. The other comment was about the standard of reasonably linkable. We got comments from industry saying, well, pretty much these days all data is reasonably linkable to a consumer computer or device. So what you're doing by articulating this broad standard is that you're not really creating incentives for companies to strip data of personal identifiers. If it's all going to be subject to the framework anyway, what incentives do companies have to try at least and strip data and get it at least more anonymous? So we thought that this was a really good point. And so we made one modification or refinement to the reasonably linkable standard. I would say the overall standard is still the same, but we put some meat on the bones. So in other words, in order to take advantage of this carve-out for data that's not reasonably linkable, you have to do three things. First, you have to take reasonable steps to de-identify the data. Second, you have to make a public commitment that you won't try to re-identify the data. And third, if you share that de-identified data with third parties, you have to have contractual provisions in place, making sure that the downstream entities won't be re-identifying the data. If you do these three things, you won't be subject to the privacy framework. So let's move on to the three principles. The first is privacy by design. And in the final report, we didn't change what we said in the preliminary report. We still say that there are four substantive privacy by design principles that companies should implement. They should implement reasonable data security, reasonable data accuracy, reasonable collection limitations, and they should dispose of data once they no longer have a business need for it. Now, on top of these substantive protections, both in our preliminary report and our final report, we said that companies should implement procedural protections. So, for example, they should hire people whose job it is to think about privacy issues. They should do employee training. They should have written policies and procedures in place as to how they're going to protect the privacy of data that they collect about consumers. Now, we haven't changed any of these standards in the final report. I will say, though, that we've sued three companies in the last year since the preliminary report was issued, where we have a privacy by design component in our order. So we settled with three companies, Google, Facebook, and MySpace, most recently last week, where all of these companies are required to put in place a comprehensive privacy program. And if you look at our orders in those cases, that gives you some ideas about what should be included in a comprehensive privacy program. So I think that, again, just fleshes out some of the privacy by design components that we think are a best practice for all companies. The next element is simplified choice. So if you looked at our preliminary report, we basically said two things. First, we said that companies don't necessarily need to seek consumer consent before engaging in any information collection practices. We think that companies shouldn't clutter up a consumer experience by providing choices for things that are either obvious from the context of the transaction or necessary for public policy reasons. So we listed five what we called commonly accepted practices. These include things like product fulfillment. So Amazon, if they're collecting your address in order to ship a book to you, they don't need to say, oh, is it okay if I share your address with the shipping company in order to ship the book to you? That's product fulfillment. It's obvious from the context of the transaction. You don't need to provide a separate consumer choice for that. Four other practices, fraud prevention, law enforcement, internal operations, some people call this product development or product improvement, and finally, first-party marketing. I think what we said was, you know, a company like, again, taking Amazon, if Amazon is making book recommendations based on your prior purchases, that's within the reasonable expectations of consumers, and they would expect that their data is going to be used that way, so you don't need to provide a choice there. So we got a lot of comments on that idea of commonly accepted practices, and we got comments both from industry and consumer groups, some suggesting that it was over-inclusive and some suggesting it was under-inclusive. So the business community said, well, you know, by setting these five commonly accepted practices in stone, you could be discouraging innovation. What if there's a practice that comes out 3 years from now that's consistent with consumers' expectations but doesn't fall within your list of five bucket? Should we really have to seek consumer choice for that? On the flip side, we got comments from consumer groups saying, well, these five practices are pretty over-inclusive. You take a category like internal operations or product development or product improvement, and let's say a company tries to improve its products in such a way that they're sharing new information with new third parties without consumer consent. A lot of consumer groups said, well, that would go against what the consumer's expectations are, and you don't want to sweep those practices into your list of five commonly accepted practices. So I think we we agreed with all of these commenters, and we said that, okay, we're going to refine this list of commonly accepted practices. It's not just an exclusive list. We're going to say that any practices that are consistent with the context of the consumer's interaction with the business, for those practices, you don't have to seek consumer choice. For all other practices, we're suggesting that companies seek consumer choice not in a privacy policy, but at a point where the consumer is actually sharing information or the company is collecting information. So it's a slight change. It's all we're saying is that these five practices that we articulated in the preliminary report are examples, and most of the time may fall into this rubric of consistent with the context of the transaction, but sometimes if they don't, you should still provide a consumer choice. On the flip side, there may be a new practice that's not included within that list of five. As long as it's consistent with the consumer's interaction with the business, you don't need to provide a consumer choice for that. I think one illustration of that, and I think probably the most controversial type of commonly accepted practice, is first-party marketing. So we had said that first-party marketing is generally consistent with the consumer's interaction with the business, and therefore it's a commonly accepted practice. So we got a lot of comments. We said, well, commenters said, well, what about companies like ISPs that do deep packet inspection? An ISP is a first party. You have a first party relationship with Comcast or Verizon or whoever else may be your ISP. Just because of that first party relationship, should they be able to track all of your activities across the web? We got another comment saying, you know, Facebook has these social widgets, so they have a like button. And just because you have a first party relationship with Facebook, does that mean that just because the like button appears on the Washington Post, that Facebook would be a first party on that Washington Post website? So we clarified in our final report that the concept of first party marketing is very limited, and again, it's based on what is consistent with the consumer's interaction with the business. So in the ISP example, we don't think it's consistent with the consumer's interaction with the ISP that they would track the contents of your online activity. Similarly with Facebook, it might be consistent that Facebook is collecting your data if you actually click on the like button, but it wouldn't necessarily be consistent with the context of your interaction if the like button just appears on a third-party page. So we clarified what it means to be a first party. We clarified what first party marketing means, and we just provided, again, some clarification of the simplified choice in that area. And the final thing I'll mention in terms of simplified choice is do not track. Do not track has certainly gotten a lot of attention in Washington, and we think it's one example of how companies can offer simplified choice to consumers. We know that there are a lot of industry organizations. There's a standard-setting body that's doing work on Do Not Track. And we think that these standard-setting bodies, these self-regulatory groups, will be able to come up with a standard that's robust, effective, simple, persistent, and that opts people out of collection, not just use of their data for behavioral advertising. So then the last element that I'll just quickly discuss is improved transparency. So one example of improved transparency is that we're calling in companies to have more streamlined privacy policies to make sure they're shorter, they're more understandable to consumers, particularly on mobile devices. We're calling in companies to improve transparency through the use of icons and other shorthands for consumers, because particularly in the mobile area, you don't want consumers scrolling through hundreds of pages of privacy notices. Another example of improved transparency is we're calling on companies to provide better access to consumers of their own information. And this is particularly important with respect to data brokers. So, for example, one of the things we're calling for is improved transparency in the data broker industry. We're asking data brokers that collect and use information for marketing purposes to create a centralized registry, some sort of website, because there's currently a lot of data brokers out there that are offering consumers choices, access, transparency about their data. But as a consumer, I don't know who Axiom is. I don't know who Intellius is. And so we're asking these companies to come together and create a website where they can at least provide information to consumers about who they are and what kinds of choices they provide to consumers about their data. So finally, let me just touch on, you know, what's the FTC going to do next in order to implement this framework? And we're going to engage in five activities. First, we're going to continue to support implementation of Do Not Track. We've been very involved. We've been providing input to these self-regulatory groups and standard-setting bodies, and we'll continue to do that so that hopefully at the end of the day we can have a meaningful Do Not Track system for consumers. Second, we're calling on the mobile industry to do more. We actually recently did a survey of mobile apps directed towards kids, and we found that many of those mobile apps were not providing any information about what they collected from especially social networks, ad networks. And so what we decided was that we should host a workshop to find out what is actually happening in the industry. Is this tracking taking place? What kinds of practices are going on? What kinds of disclosures are being provided? And we're going to compare and contrast these practices through a workshop during the second half of 2012. Fourth, I already mentioned the data broker industry. We're calling on data brokers to create this centralized website, and we're going to be working more with the data brokers to make that come to fruition. And then finally, we're going to be working with the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce is undertaking a project to create these multi-stakeholder groups to develop codes of conduct in particular industries. We hope to work with the Department of Commerce. We hope to provide input on these processes because I think one of the things that we're going to do at the end of the day is, to the extent that robust codes of conduct are developed, we would look at those codes favorably as we look at FTC enforcement under Section 5. So that's kind of a brief nutshell. I'm happy to answer any questions. So I'll turn over the mic to Chris.
Great. Thank you for the terrific summary, Venetia. I'm going to moderate questions from the audience. Let me take the moderator's prerogative and ask the first one. Did I hear you correctly to say that the report contains recommended best practices but not enforceable principles? Because of that, that's not how many of us read the report when it came out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. These are best practices. Now, there may be some things that we highlight in the report that we already have the ability to do under Section 5. So, for example, if a company makes a deceptive statement in a privacy policy, we can sue the company for a violation of the FTC Act. If the company does not implement reasonable data security, we can sue the company for violating the FTC Act. But by and large, the principles that we articulate in the report are best practices. So unless Congress enacts legislation, this is not going to be a roadmap for how the FTC is going to enforce the FTC Act currently. It's simply a template for best practices.
Let me see if I can quibble with that just a little bit. In your enforcement actions, you sometimes establish new best practices, such as in the comprehensive privacy program requirements, and even in the recent MySpace enforcement action. And many of us view those enforcement actions as a new common law of FTC Section 5 enforcement. Is that a correct way to interpret the actions that follow the report?
I would quibble with that a little bit. So I think you'd have to take the complaints and the order separately. So if you look at the complaints in those cases, these are the companies that had misleading statements in their privacy policies. So if you take MySpace, MySpace said, we won't share your personal information with advertisers, and they did. So that is classic enforcement under Section 5 of the FTC Act. So if you take a look at our order, one of the remedies for that practice was to implement this comprehensive privacy program. That's not something that we can simply impose. So, for example, if a company didn't have a comprehensive privacy program, I'm not sure that we could take action against that company under Section 5. We did impose it as a remedy in these cases for companies that were deceiving consumers or making unfair decisions.
I'll ask one more, then I'll open it up to the audience. But what about the idea of the friend ID standing alone, not being paid PII, but because the friend ID could be Googled and therefore combined with PII, it was basically contextual PII? That's kind of a new principle, isn't it?
I don't think it may be an incrementally new principle in that we haven't brought this kind of case before, but if you take a look at our Netflix closing letter, for example, Netflix was a company that they put out they were trying to improve their algorithm for making movie recommendations, and they were going to put out people's movie cues, quote, anonymously, and we did take a look at it at Netflix under Section 5, so even though they weren't actually sharing PII, quote, unquote, traditionally, we did think that it was under our authority under Section 5 to take a look at their practices, even for data that was not traditionally PII. So I'd say the MySpace case is simply an extension of that. Even though the friend ID itself may not be PII in the traditional sense, it certainly is a pointer to PII, and it's pretty easy to find the consumer's full name and address once they
Thank you. Questions from the audience, sir. Can you identify yourself, please?
Thank you.
just make 2 points in response to that. I think that was part of the reason why we put out these three principles, saying that, you know, you have to take reasonable steps, you have to publicly commit, and you have to have contractual protections in place. But I think this is a question I get often. You know, I think a lot of our work is based on reasonableness. And sure, it has the disadvantage that it's unpredictable and it doesn't provide guidance. But at the same time, these concepts do change over time. And I don't think that you can have a static interpretation of what is PII and not PII in 2012 that won't change 5 years from now. So I think by setting standards in stone, you are creating gaps in consumer protection. And I think that we do try to provide guidance, as Chris said, through our cases as to what is reasonable and what is not. And we don't bring cases involving close calls. Yeah, but I think we make those judgments in law all the time. Like, if you look at our data security cases, we say that companies have to implement reasonable data security. A lot of times companies will tell us, well, can you give us a checklist of what's reasonable and what's not reasonable? And I guess my response is that as a government agency, we're not the ones who have our finger on the pulse of technology. We think that the private sector should make those judgments, and we'll police on the line, not on the line, but where a company has really gone far beyond the line.
Other questions?
Sure. I think one of the things we say, we do articulate five categories of sensitive information in the report: health information, financial, children, geolocation, and social security numbers. Now, I think at least the health category, I think that's probably one of the thorniest ones, because we all agree that things like, you know, medical condition, the fact that I have AIDS, the fact that I have cancer, the fact that I have diabetes, that's sensitive. But what about the fact that I have a broken arm? Or that I'm taking Tylenol, or the fact that, you know, I'm bald and I need Rogaine. What might be sensitive to some may not be sensitive to others. So we haven't really taken a position on whether some of that information is sensitive, but we think that if you apply all of the elements of the framework, that there could be protection for all data, even if it's on the line. So, for example, you know, even though the fact that I take Tylenol may or may not be sensitive, the fact that I can have access to data that a pharmacy has about me, that can help me give me an additional check to see what data companies are collecting. And if I think it's sensitive, I can ask to opt out of that. So it's a difficult question, but I do think we try to provide some guidance in the report.
Other questions, sir?
So I should have mentioned at the outset that our report focuses solely on commercial data practices, so we don't take any positions on government collection and use of data. I will say at the FTC, we have a pretty robust privacy program. We have a chief privacy officer, and we're not asking companies to do anything that we don't do with the data we collect. So I can only speak to the FTC, but I think it's a good question as to the broader government implications.
Thank you.
say our strongest piece of guidance is our ChoicePoint case, which ChoicePoint is a data broker, and they were providing information to known identity thieves, as we alleged, and we got $10 million in civil penalties and $5 million in consumer redress in that case. So I think the message of that case and our report as well is that all companies that collect consumer data and maintain consumer data need to have reasonable security to protect against a breach. And what we've always said is it's not about the breach. It's about keeping data secure. So even if you don't have a breach, and if you don't have reasonable practices, we can still bring an enforcement action against you. But I think the message for data brokers is you've got to maintain reasonable security if you're collecting consumer data.
Steve, unfortunately, I missed the Avengers this weekend, but I feel like I just watched a trailer for the Enforcers. That's really the record you have. And there's something you said I want to ask about. Back in March, Mrs. Levi told this group, quote, that the FTC powers only car companies who volunteer to have codes or policies. And then Danny Weitzner in April told this group that we need a law because government can't compel companies to have a privacy policy. I think you said basically the same thing. But Commissioner Rush, for instance, is here nodding because he sometimes says that if a company is collecting information and doesn't have a privacy policy, then they're leaving a material omission of important information, and that he believed at least that the FTC did have jurisdiction over companies who failed to disclose any privacy policy at all. Is the book closed on that, or is that still an open question that should inform what Congress does in terms of whether we need a new law or not?
Sure. So I do think that I think we have to approach it on a case-by-case basis. I don't think that every failure to have a privacy policy would be actionable under Section 5. So I do think that there are certain gaps in our enforcement authority, and that's why we've asked Congress to consider enacting legislation to fill those gaps. But I also don't want to mislead anybody and say that you have to have a privacy policy in order for us to bring an action against you under Section 5. You know, there could be material omissions that are actionable. So a recent example is a case we brought against YouPromise. This is a company that had a toolbar. You could download the toolbar, and it would identify partners where you could shop and save money for college. And YouPromise said, you can download this toolbar, and we will track the websites you visit. But what YouPromise was also doing was tracking information about secure web pages. They were tracking information in shopping carts, information on forms. And so we said that this was a deceptive practice. It was a deceptive omission to fail to disclose the fact that you were actually tracking consumers much more broadly than their web surfing behavior. So it's just an example where, you know, it's not that you need a privacy policy, but it's not that Section 5 can cover everything.
What about an app that collects a lot of sensitive information that has no privacy policy at all?
Stay tuned. I would just say that we would have to look at that on a case-by-case basis.
Just on the same, California has a law requiring privacy policies for wives of the commercial actors with California customers. Does that end up taking care of a big fraction of this because most people do business in California? How much is this sort of a non-issue because people actually do business in California?
Well, I mean, I do know, you know, I think that most companies, most reputable companies have privacy policies. I think what I was surprised at is this mobile report that we did a couple of months ago where we found that these companies were not giving any information to consumers. These apps were not giving any information to consumers prior to downloading the app. So I think there are gaps. I don't think the California law completely
exists. On your point, I'm not aware of any enforcement of that law. Maybe others are. Other questions?